Hub
and Spoke Audio Collective.
We can have the future we want, but we have to work for it.
You're listening to Soonish. I'm Wade Rausch. What if I told you that your favorite neighborhood restaurant tries to trick you into ordering food you don't really want and spies on you after you leave? What if I pointed out that the TV behind the bar is always tuned to salacious or inflammatory programs designed to grab your attention and make you stay and order a few more drinks? What if you learned that this restaurant uses its buying power to put other restaurants out of business and keep new ones from opening? And what if it turned out that every time one of this restaurant's workers speaks up about these bad business practices, they get instantly fired? You'd probably stop eating at this restaurant. You'd vote with your fork and you'd go somewhere else. Well, for me, Google is that restaurant. I'm fed up with the way the search and advertising giant manipulates our attention, stifles competition, and sidelines minority voices. So about 5 months ago, I decided to stop using Google's products and find alternatives wherever I could. It turns out that's a little harder than just walking out of one restaurant and going to another one down the street. In the physical world, there are plenty of places to eat. In the digital world, Google has a near monopoly in the search and advertising businesses. It also dominates in mobile operating systems, web browsers, video streaming, and email platforms. From a consumer's point of view, it's like living in a city where a single company owns 90% of the restaurants and sells 75% of the cars and owns 74% of the movie theaters and also has a contract to operate most of the libraries and post offices. That would be a pretty dystopian place to live. But it's a pretty accurate analogy for the extent of Google's power over the internet. But there are still some alternatives to Google. I'm using some of them myself. Later in the show, I'll explain more about why I'm so disappointed in Google and why its founding motto, "Don't be evil," is starting to sound so ironic. The straw that broke the camel's back for me came last winter when Google fired a black computer scientist and AI ethicist named Timnit Gebru for doing exactly what the company had ostensibly brought her in to do in the first place, which was to think critically about the company's artificial intelligence efforts. But before I get to that, I want to make a couple things clear. First off, I still think Google is a remarkable company. I know a lot of people who work there or have worked there in the past. Most of them are super smart folks who just want to use technology to make the world better. The problem is the products they've built work so well that they've created a juggernaut that crushes everything in its path. Also, it turns out that Google's main business model is toxic for democracy. So there's that. But the second thing I want to make clear is that I'm not necessarily trying to persuade you to get Google out of your life. I just want to show that it's possible, and maybe give you some ideas and options if you do decide to give it a try. In that sense, this episode is a sequel to a show I made in 2019 called A Future Without Facebook. I explained in that episode why I decided it was time for me to quit Facebook. I was clear about my own views that Facebook is destroying our democracy, but I wasn't trying to guilt anyone else into quitting. I was much more interested in getting people just to think about the looming presence of the big tech companies in our lives, and how we should feel about that, and most importantly, what we can do about it. Now, if you remember the Facebook episode, you may also remember one of the guests from that show, Mark Hurst. Mark runs a product design consultancy in New York City called Creative Good, and he's the host of a terrific radio show and podcast from WFMU called Tectonic. And when he sees the big tech companies making decisions that are bad for democracy or hostile toward customers, he's an absolutely fearless critic. So I called him up to talk about Google. I want to start off by asking you about Good Reports, which is an offshoot of your larger effort at Creative Good. But it's a place where people can go to figure out what are the alternatives to some of the services and products they get from the big tech companies, right?
Yeah, it started when I put together a little booklet, actually as part of my radio show with WFMU. I put together a tips booklet because listeners would often ask, well, if I am supposed to get off Google, like you say, where am I supposed to go? And so I put a little tips booklet together of the best web browser and the best email and the best search engine, that sort of thing. And then I realized as I put it together, there's so many more tips that I'm coming across than I can fit into a printed booklet. So I launched Good Reports as a catch-all site where I can post all of the pointers to actually good tools out there that don't engage in surveillance capitalism. They're not captured by big tech yet. It's at goodreports.com, and it's just my attempt to point people to all of the alternatives to Google and other big tech services that they can and should switch over to.
Mark, what would you say is the behavior you're trying to enable or encourage?
Well, the problem right now is that if you're going to search, you're going to use Google because that's what everybody does. It's the default choice. If you use a web browser, you're probably going to use Google Chrome. If you use email, you're probably going to use Gmail. And if you use social media, it's either going to be Facebook or Instagram, something owned by Mark Zuckerberg. And these default tools tend to be really harmful, both to the users individually and their communities, and as we see democracy under threat worldwide, these tools are harmful on a global scale. And so the behavior that I'm trying to encourage is for people to look beyond the defaults and learn about less harmful tools that are out there and then put in a little bit of effort to switch over to those tools. And it's generally not very difficult to go through this process. It just takes a little bit of time. So with Good Reports, I'm trying to make it as easy as possible for people to learn what the options are, why they should switch, and how they should switch.
And Good Reports is divided up into kind of product categories like web browsers, email platforms, mobile devices, all these categories. One of the difficulties, though, with Google is that it crosses a bunch of these categories. As you just said, if you're an average consumer, without realizing it, you could pretty easily wind up using Google Chrome as your browser. You could wind up using Google itself as your search engine, Gmail as your email provider, Android as your mobile operating system, you know, YouTube as your video platform. So getting Google out of your life actually isn't all that simple because you have to think about all of these different kinds of services you use and how to extricate yourself from each one of them separately.
Well, I would push back on that framing just a little bit. I mean, everything you said there, Wade, is true and accurate. So I don't mean to dispute anything you just said. But I think there's a better way of framing this, which is that we shouldn't think about getting completely free of Google or removing Google completely from our lives, at least as an initial goal. Because as you say, that is incredibly difficult. We're not doing people any favors if we make it seem so difficult to get off of big tech. Baby steps, Wade. Let's start with some easy things people can do, and you do them one at a time. I mean, people can stop using Google search like that. It's so easy. You just don't use Google search anymore. You go to either DuckDuckGo or I have several options on the search engine page at Good Reports, and just start doing your searches through a different search engine. It's free and it's easy. And once you see that you didn't die, the internet still works, you're getting good search results, it's okay, and you have some sense that you're being tracked less, then you might want to try something as a follow-on step. Maybe you want to try downloading a different browser so that you start weaning yourself off of Google Chrome. But it's a process. And it may be, Wade, that you're right, that we can never get 100% off of Google. That may be the case. But it's worth taking some basic steps to lop off big chunks of Google's influence and see where it takes us.
At the moment, DuckDuckGo is the top recommended alternative search engine at Good Reports. And I just wanted to ask whether that's your preferred search engine. And do you find that DuckDuckGo works just as well as Google used to for you?
Yeah. All of these recommendations at Good Reports. They're my own personal recommendations. And I mean, I'm able to function fine, Wade. my search queries are met just fine. Maybe someone else out there will say, well, I have a very specific query that I need a different search engine for. And I understand there are some edge cases where Google or maybe some other alternate search engine might be a better choice. But once again, just getting people aware that there are alternatives and getting them to try out some alternatives, whether it's DuckDuckGo or Ecosia or Quant or any of the others, that's a big step. I'm just trying to get people to look beyond these default toxic services from the big tech companies.
I also switched to DuckDuckGo at the beginning of this year, and I agree with Mark. It does everything a search engine should do. And in a minute, we'll explore some of the other tools that you can use as alternatives to Google's products. But first, I want to back up and talk about why I decided that it's time for me to quit Google. For years, I'd been concerned about some disturbing trends at the company. I didn't like the way Google tracks our search histories and then uses these small digital files called cookies to follow us around on the web and show us ads related to our search terms. A lot of people were creeped out by that practice. So many that Google agreed to stop using cookies on its Chrome browser by 2022. But it plans to replace those cookies with a different profiling technology that in some ways is just as invasive. The problem that scared me the most, though, was with Google's video sharing site, YouTube. There's a pile of evidence these days that the recommendation algorithms built into YouTube have helped to radicalize users by pulling them farther and farther into a universe of crazy conspiracy theories. These algorithms are the ones that determine which videos appear on the Up Next list, alongside whatever video the user is watching right now. They're responsible for 70% of the time that users spend on YouTube, which means, of course, that they're also driving 70% of YouTube's advertising revenue. From all the coverage I've been reading, I'm pretty convinced that these algorithms are amplifying the racism and the far-right extremism that made the 2016 and 2020 presidential elections so contentious, and that culminated in the January 6th insurrection. And then something else happened.
Still ahead, the controversy surrounding a top AI researcher. Google says she resigned. She says she was fired. Timnit Gebru joins us to tell us her side of the story next. This is Bloomberg.
In related news, Google employees are demanding senior leadership reinstate prominent black researcher Timnit Gebru, who alleged she was fired earlier this month after arguing tech companies should do more to ensure gender-biased and racist language are not exacerbated by artificial intelligence systems. And in labor news...
So if you've seen the recent Netflix documentary Coded Bias, which you definitely should, you know there's a problem in AI research right now called algorithmic bias. It's one of the challenges that can crop up when you program software to recognize patterns, like words or faces, using machine learning. The only way to get machine learning algorithms to recognize anything is to train them over and over on existing data. So they learn, yep, that's an eye. Yep, that's a nose. Nope, that's not a cat. But let's say you're teaching an algorithm to recognize faces and your training data is scraped from the internet and consists mostly of faces of white people. In that case, your algorithm may not be very good at identifying black people. And let's say those algorithms wind up being used in law enforcement. It's not hard to imagine how software that misidentifies one whole segment of the population could help to amplify the same biases that have already led to so much police violence against black people. Timnit Gebru was one of the experts featured in Coded Bias, and she spent her career documenting the risks built into certain forms of machine learning, including both face recognition and natural language processing, or NLP. NLP is one of the technologies that powers virtual assistants like Siri, Alexa, and Google Assistant. And you won't be surprised to hear that Google has built some of the most powerful NLP algorithms in existence. Gebru was the technical co-lead of Google's ethical AI team, and in 2020, she co-authored a paper for a computer science conference arguing that language models, like Google's, that are built on gigantic datasets, can too easily wind up reflecting the gender biases and racial biases present in the original training data. Google executives who reviewed the paper thought it was too harsh, and they asked Gebru not to publish it. What happened next is disputed, but it comes down to this. Gebru sent her managers a letter where she asked to know which executives at Google wanted to keep the paper from being published and threatened to resign unless she got that information. Gebru says she wasn't actually resigning, just demanding some information. But Google looked at that letter and said, okay, resignation accepted. A few months later, Google also fired Margaret Mitchell, the other co-lead of the ethical AI team, allegedly for searching through corporate email accounts to find evidence that Gebru had been unfairly targeted. Now, we can argue all day about whether Gebru's threat to resign was the same as an actual resignation, or whether Mitchell misused her email account. But what's clear is that the episode shocked and disturbed many people inside and outside Google. More than 1,500 Google employees signed a petition demanding that Gebru be rehired, which hasn't happened. But Google's AI chief, Jeff Dean, did acknowledge in an internal email that the company regretted the way the incident had led some black and female technologists to, quote, question their place here, unquote. Dean also said that the company, quote, should have handled this situation more sensitively, unquote. But the central point remains. The moment that the leaders of Google's ethical AI team turned their critical lens on Google itself, the company decided it didn't need them around. And to me, that's the kind of hypocrisy and tone deafness that you'd expect from some autocratic regime in Eastern Europe, not from a Silicon Valley tech company that controls some of the most important pieces of our information economy.
As I see it, the reason Timnit got fired is because she very calmly told the truth about some of the problems in Google's AI algorithms.
That's Mark Hurst again.
And Google, for all of their public pronouncements about diversity and ethics and so on, the moment anyone says something true about the disadvantages of Google's approach, they're out. Google cannot brook any dissent. And so just taking Timnit's example, do you want to use the services of a company that is, as you say, Wade, $1.6 trillion company that cannot brook any dissent, any questioning, or any mild revelation of the disadvantages, not even to get to the horrifying toxicity of some of the things that happen on YouTube and other services, just a couple of questions in a scholarly paper about the ethics of their AI algorithms, and they're out. Do you want to do business with a company like that? So that's just 2 minutes on my basic thoughts on Timnit Gebru. But I could talk about their monopolistic behavior, the anti-competitive squelching of real innovation online, their surveillance capitalism, tracking everyone everywhere they go, and essentially lying about it when they're questioned under oath. It's unbelievable to me that we allow a company like this to exist at all, to continue operation at all. I mean, I saw yesterday the news that the Ohio Attorney General wants to turn Google into a public utility, which is kind of an interesting development. Why don't we start by shutting down the entire company for what it's done? That'd be my proposal. Let's shut down the entire Google enterprise and then talk about how to build something that is not so horribly exploitative in its place.
I mean, if you gave me a magic wand and I could shut down a Silicon Valley giant company, I think I would start with Facebook, but whatever.
Wade, I'm sorry. It's a tie. In the race to be the most horribly exploitative evil company in the country, Facebook and Google, they're just neck and neck every single day. So I'd agree with you, Wade. Let's shut Facebook down. But if we do that, then the same day, let's shut Google down as well.
I want to be clear. I respect Mark's opinion, but I'm not saying let's shut down Google. I'm just saying that the Timnit Gebru incident was my personal breaking point. When I decided it was time to stop contributing to Google's vast online empire and do what I could to hold the company accountable for its actions. How to do that is exactly what I'll talk about right after this break. if you've made it this far into the show. I know you're a committed listener. So here's the part where I ask you for some help. Soonish is an independent podcast, meaning it's funded by me, not by a public media station or some giant streaming audio network. I love that independence, and I do have a few ways to cover my costs, including my writing gigs and the audio production work I do for some other shows. But your donations to Soonish also make a real difference. So, if you like this show and you care about independent podcasting, please go to patreon.com/soonish and sign up to give $5 per episode. At that level, you'll get early access to every new episode of the show. At the $10 per episode level, I'll send you the Soonish coffee mug with our season 4 motto and logo. And at higher levels, we have even cooler benefits. Find out more about all of our rewards at patreon.com/soonish. And thanks. So let's say, for whatever reason, you want to escape from the Google ecosystem. How do you even do that? Well, the first and most obvious step is just to use a different search engine. As Mark Hurst and I were discussing earlier, there is a great one called DuckDuckGo that doesn't track your search history at all, and therefore doesn't follow you around the web, showing you ads for the stuff that you just searched. But there are other choices too, including a search engine called Quant, Q-W-A-N-T, and another one called Ecosia. And there's an even newer search engine from some Google alumni called Neeva, N-E-E-V-A, and that one works on a subscription model. I asked Mark what he thought of that.
I mean, the old adage is, you know, if you're not the customer, you're the product, and they're trying to short-circuit that by charging people directly. Do you see anything in that kind of model?
Yeah, I think it's a possible future. I mean, we've just, on the big tech side, we've just seen recently that Twitter announced, Twitter Blue, a subscription product for some of their advanced users. I have said and written for years now that algorithmic amplification as a profit driver is completely wrong. It's wrong ethically, morally, all sorts of ways it's wrong. And a subscription business allowing people to pay for the service on a monthly basis is fundamentally, it gives a better chance that it's a fair and equitable service that's not exploiting anybody along the chain. So what Neeva has announced is interesting. I don't want to come across as, you know, super biased, but I am aware that some of the money that made it possible for Neeva to launch came from Google in the net worth of the individuals who have left Google. And I am always a little bit skeptical of a team that was born and raised in Silicon Valley with Silicon Valley money, because I've seen a lot of startups come out of Silicon Valley and they say, oh, well, we're going to be real different. We have this alternative business model. And within a few years, they revert to the mean of Silicon Valley, which is totally over-financialized operations and some hidden exploitation that they always deny, and all of the other toxic practices that we see out there.
Well, you're hitting on an important theme here, I think, which has to do with just having greater awareness as a consumer of internet services and technologies of all kinds. I mean, you're asking people to pay a certain amount of attention to the companies and teams behind these products and to track them over time. So, you know, even a company like DuckDuckGo could go down the dark path, right? Eventually, their hearts are in the right place right now, but who's to say what might happen there over 5 or 10 years?
That's why it's important, by the way, to maintain Good Reports as a website and not, you know, etched in stone somewhere. All of this is fluid. Everything online is fluid and it can change. You're exactly right. And so, yes, we have to keep an eye on the tools and the teams and the companies and the business models out there that we like today, because tomorrow they could flip on us.
One thing to know is that the web browsers on your desktop or your mobile phone are set to use one search engine by default. And most people have that default set to Google. But it's easy to change it to DuckDuckGo just by going into the preferences setting on your browser. Now, after you switch to a new search engine, some of the other steps are a little harder. I think Mark is right that it's self-defeating to try to do all of them at once. Just take it one step at a time. When you're ready, the next thing to do is to stop using Google Chrome if that's your browser. There are plenty of good alternatives. I use Mozilla Firefox, but lots of people prefer Apple's Safari browser. Microsoft makes a good browser called Edge, and even DuckDuckGo makes a nice mobile browser for your phone. When you do download a new browser, just be sure to set the default search engine to something other than Google. All right, next is email. This is a tough one. Google's free Gmail service has a global market share of somewhere between 40 and 45%. And I understand why. It's really good. Again, there are excellent alternatives, but they're going to cost you a little money. I think you need to be able to see that as a good thing. As I said earlier, if you're not paying for the product, you are the product, meaning that the provider is monetizing your attention by collecting your personal and behavioral data in order to show you targeted ads. The solution is to pay up front for a product that isn't supported by advertising. Over at Good Reports, Mark recommends a paid email service called Fastmail. I haven't tried that one, but I can give a 5-star rating to ProtonMail, which is the service I switched over to. ProtonMail charges $48 a year for its basic plan. And the main selling point is that the company is obsessed with privacy and security. All emails on ProtonMail are end-to-end encrypted, meaning that even ProtonMail can't read them. And the company's entire infrastructure is based in Switzerland, so your emails are stored on servers in an underground bunker 1,000 meters below the Swiss Alps. ProtonMail has a browser-based interface for your desktop or laptop and a dedicated mobile app for your phone. To be honest, neither one of these is as elegant as Gmail. But that might be an advantage too. I spend too much time on email as it is, and I just want to finish and get out of there. So I'm perfectly happy with a bare-bones email app that isn't designed to keep me logged in for as long as possible. Next is mobile phones. This one's also tough because so many people own phones with Google's Android operating system. The obvious alternative is to switch to an Apple iPhone the next time you replace your phone. But iPhones are expensive, and not everybody likes Apple. If you have an Android phone, it is possible, believe it or not, to remove the operating system and replace it with a third-party OS. One of the leading ones is called Graphene OS. For details, you can go and look at the mobile device page at Good Reports.
Five.
Now for some easy stuff. There's actually a whole list of Google apps and services that are relatively easy to avoid. The best alternative for you will depend partly on what kind of phone and what kind of computer you have. Instead of using Google Play to get your music, you can use Bandcamp or Apple Music.
Six.
Instead of Google Maps, you can use Apple Maps, which is a lot better than it used to be. And then there's also Bing Maps from Microsoft and OpenStreetMaps.
Seven.
Instead of Google Calendar, you can use iCloud Calendar if you're an Apple person, or the calendar built into Microsoft Outlook if you're a Windows person.
Eight.
If you collaborate a lot using Google Docs or Google Sheets, there's always the suite of iWork apps from Apple, and the online version of Microsoft Office, which I think is now called Microsoft 365. And there are a lot of other perfectly good cloud-based office suites, like Zoho.
Nine.
For online storage, you're going to want to get everything off of Google Drive and move it onto Dropbox, or Box.com, or Microsoft OneDrive.
Ten.
For photos, you'll need to replace Google Photos and use Apple's iCloud photo service if you're an Apple person. If you're on Android, you can get a pro account at Flickr for $60 per year. Or you can just save a copy of all of your photos on Dropbox or your preferred cloud storage service. And this probably goes without saying, but if you want to avoid Google altogether, you shouldn't buy a Google Chromebook computer or a Google Home smart speaker or a Nest thermostat or any other device made by Google. Now here's a very important tip. If you've been a Google user for a long time, you probably have oodles of personal data sitting on Google's servers. And you're going to want to copy all that data back to your computer at home before you cancel any of your Google services. Fortunately, Google does take the position that your data is yours, and it's built a fairly good tool for downloading it. It's called Google Takeout, and you can find it by signing into your Google account and going to takeout.google.com. When I went to Google Takeout, I learned that the company was storing a whopping 340 gigabytes of my data. Most of that was photos and videos, but it also included 17 years worth of Gmail messages and attachments. When you use Takeout, Google bundles all of your data together and lets you download it in chunks, 2 gigabytes at a time, which means I had to download 170 separate files. Once you've downloaded all your data using Takeout, you can go back to Google and delete the online versions of your photos and videos and emails and other files. And then, finally, you'll be ready to close your Google account once and for all. Now, I want to be clear that there are 2 major hurdles that make it almost impossible to get Google completely out of your life. The first one is YouTube. There just isn't a good alternative place to browse videos. And the truth is that there's a ton of valuable content on YouTube, about everything from the history of Tudor England to how to fix your washing machine. If you're a video maker and you just need a place to upload your videos so that you can share them with others, then I recommend subscribing to Vimeo. But if you're somebody who mainly just watches YouTube videos, there really isn't any other place to go. The one saving grace is that you don't have to have a Google account to watch YouTube videos. If you're not signed into YouTube, you can't dislike, like, or comment on videos, and also you won't be able to watch age-restricted videos. Google won't know who you are, so it won't be able to steer you to the 3,000th video about Star Wars memes or baking, but as we said earlier, you don't really want those recommendation algorithms in your life in the first place. The other thing that makes it almost impossible to avoid Google is that the company's tools are embedded so deeply in the World Wide Web. If you wanted to avoid every web page that pulls its ads from Google, or uses Google Analytics to monitor traffic, or uses Google Fonts to make its text pretty, you'd basically have to stop using the web altogether. So the bottom line is that when you decide to exit the Google ecosystem, it's not about absolutes, it's about degrees and shades of gray. I like to use the metaphor of reducitarianism. If you put people's opinions about eating meat on a spectrum, you'd have the carnivores at one end and the vegans at the other. And somewhere in the middle, you have reducitarians. Those are folks who don't swear off meat entirely, but do cut way back on their meat consumption for ethical or environmental reasons. You can be a Google reducitarian, and that's totally fine. For sure, it's way better than doing nothing. But that kind of begs one final question. Google isn't the only giant tech company we should be worried about. For instance, it would have been just as easy for me to put together a whole episode about why everyone should quit buying stuff on Amazon. So once you start down this road of opting out of the economy built by the tech giants, where does it end? Do we all have to wind up as hermits living off-grid in some cabin in Wyoming? And when we do exercise our choices as consumers, do these trillion-dollar companies notice any impact at all? That's what I wanted to talk about in the final part of my conversation with Mark Hurst. I have personally deleted my Facebook profile long since, right? We did a whole episode about that. I'm in the process of leaving Google. But I want to get at a bigger question here because we're enmeshed in the networks and the schemes of many of these tech giants. Not you, Mark. You've done a great job of unenmeshing yourself. The rest of us are still working on it. I guess I want to ask you about, am I opening myself up to charges of hypocrisy if I continue to use the services of some tech giants like Amazon or Netflix or Apple or Microsoft while working so hard to rid myself of my connections with Facebook and Google?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I've put myself right there with you, Wade. I mean, I still use big tech services. I carry an iPhone. My family's a subscriber to Netflix. You know, I'm speaking to you on a Zoom connection that is running on a MacBook Pro that was designed by Apple and manufactured probably completely in China. And let's just take that example for a moment. This week on my Tectonic episode, I interviewed an author named Amelia Pong, who wrote a book called Made in China, which talks about forced labor in China that takes place in detention centers and basically slave labor factories, essentially. They're called different things. And occasionally we see news that suppliers to the company, these big tech companies, are implicated in forced labor. And I recommend that people read the book made in China by Amelia Pong, if they want the details, and they're nightmarish. I'll just tell you, Wade, they're nightmarish. So reading that book and talking to Amelia and realizing that this computer I'm talking to you on, this MacBook Pro, was probably made in part through forced labor. Have I given away the computer? Have I sent it to the recycling facility? No, I'm still using it. And my conclusion is that we're all enmeshed, to use your word, or to use my word, we're all complicit in the sins of this global big tech dominated economy. We're all complicit. So what do we want to do about it when you really look at it? And I think it's really important for us to take the time to become aware about how we're complicit, look at the details, understand the forced labor, understand the economics and the business models that Google and Apple and others are reliant on. And when we gain that awareness, we may find it's impossible to extricate ourselves from the system totally. But here's the good news. With the awareness, we can make some local choices to improve things. And who knows where that'll lead, Wade, if enough of us make the decision to extricate ourselves from Google to the point of this episode. Maybe if enough of us do that, we'll form a movement and other companies will see an opportunity to build less exploitative tools for us. You know, we'll start to build some momentum. You got to start somewhere. This is to my point earlier that setting a goal of getting ourselves 100% off of Google is unrealistic. And I think it's a little bit of a harmful goal because it's so hard that people are going to give up early on. But instead, let's have a goal of learning what's happening in the world and then making some choices for ourselves, some small choices at first, how we want to do things differently, and to have some humility about it.
Do you feel like this strategy of individual level boycott or renunciation can add up to something meaningful down the road? How does it change things when an individual decides to stop using Google, stop buying Apple products, stop being on Facebook, whatever it might be? That's something I worry about, because it's sort of the same question as, like, how much difference does it make for one person to become a vegan when there are still, you know, 6 billion carnivores on the planet?
Yeah, great question. Why be a vegan or a vegetarian? Here, let me add to that list of questions. Why recycle? Why vote, Wade? Are you kidding? When is the last time an election was determined by one vote? Why be polite to people on the subway here in New York City? Why do anything individually, Wade, that is against our immediate interest of comfort and pleasure and convenience? Why do anything for anybody else? I mean, I've heard this over the years. Mark, why do you tell people to get off of Facebook? Do you think Mark Zuckerberg cares that one more listener of yours deleted their Facebook account? Do you understand how many billions, you know, I've heard all of it, Wade. And I just want to say, do you vote? Do you do anything that's helpful for someone else? Why? What does it matter in the grand scheme? Not to get too deep in this conversation about Google, Wade, but these questions around what we should be doing with technology, they quickly lead to questions of ultimate values and meaning. Why are we here, Wade? Why are we on this earth? What are we supposed to do with our lives? What do our lives mean? Is it only meaningful if we have $1 billion of net worth, as counted by the NASDAQ gods? Is there any other meaning in this life? Personally, I think that there is meaning in self-sacrifice and doing something that's helpful to someone other than yourself. And if by making some of these changes in my own habits with technology, I'm starving Google just a little bit of a few bits of personal data, then maybe I have added my vote to tear down that company. And that's all I can do. I can't save the world. I'm just one person. But it's really a question of, what do you believe in, and what are your values by which you want to live your life.
Okay, Mark. Thank you so much, sir. Always great to talk to you. And when I make the decision to get rid of Apple, I'll come back to you again.
This will be an ongoing series, yeah. how to get off each one of these. I really appreciate you bringing me back on the show, Wade, and keep up the great work.
Thanks so much. Okay, take care, Mark. Soonish is written and produced by me, Wade Rausch. Our intro theme is by Graham Gordon Ramsey. Our outro theme and all the other music in this episode is from Title Card Music and Sound. You can follow the show on Twitter at Soonish Podcast, and you can check out a transcript of this episode and links to more resources on our website at soonishpodcast.org. Also at the website, I'll be publishing a bunch of links to how-to articles about getting off Google and a helpful checklist of things to remember. Soonish is a proud founding member of Hub & Spoke, a nonprofit collective of indie producers making some of the smartest audio out there. And this week, I want to urge you to check out the world's very first podcast, Open Source, a show about arts, ideas, and politics. In one recent episode, host Christopher Lydon talks to the writers Joshua Cohen, Saeed Kashua, and Bernard Avishai about the end of the Netanyahu era in Israel, in fiction and beyond. Listen at radioopensource.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the whole Hub & Spoke lineup at hubspokeaudio.org. This episode brings the fourth season of Soonish to a close. And what a weird season it was, stretching all the way from the early days of the coronavirus pandemic to the chaos around the U.S. presidential election, and finally to this season of cautious reemergence. It's been quite a journey. And I want to thank all of you for coming along with me. Now I'll be taking some time to rest and travel and catch up with my family, and also to rethink the show a bit before I dive into new episodes for season 5. I'll be back in your podcast feed this fall, which, in the grand scheme of things, still counts as
Soonish.